Up, up, up we went, past all the other famous titles. Most of them had to share floors, with one flanking each side of the receptionist's desk, facing off behind separate glass doors. I hopped off at the 17th floor, checking my butt in the reflection of the door's glass. In a stroke of empathy and genius, the architect had kindly left mirrors out of the elevators in 640 Madison. As usual, I'd forgotten my electronic ID card, the very same one that tracked all our movements, purchases, and absences in the building, and had to break onto the floor. Sophie didn't come in until 9, so I had to bend down under her desk, find the button that would release the glass doors, and sprint from the middle of the reception area to the doors and yank them open before they snapped locked again. Sometimes I'd have to do this 3 or 4 times until I finally caught it, but today I made it on my second attempt. The floor was always dark when I arrived, and I took the same route to my desk every morning. To my left, when I walked in, was the advertising department, the girls who most loved adorning themselves in Chloe t-shirts and spike-heeled boots while handing out business cards that screamed, "Runway." They were removed, wholly and entirely, from anything and everything that took place on the editorial side of the floor. It was editorial that picked the clothes for the fashion spreads, wooed the good writers, matched the accessories to the outfits, interviewed the models, edited the copy, designed the layouts, and hired the photographers. Editorial traveled to hotspots around the world for shoots, got free gifts and discounts from all the designers, hunted for trends, and went to parties at Pastis and Float because they had to check out what people were wearing. Ad sales was left to try and sell ad space. Sometimes they threw promotional parties, but they were celebrity-free and therefore boring to New York's hipster scene, or so Emily had sneeringly told me. My phone would ring off the hook on a day during a runway ad sales party with people I didn't know really well looking for an invite.
I hear Runway's having a party tonight. Why am I not invited?
I always found out from someone on the outside that there was a party that night. Editorial was never invited because they wouldn't go anyway. As if it wasn't enough for the Runway girls to mock, terrorize, and ostracize any and every person who wasn't one of them, they had to create internal class lines as well. The ad sales department gave way to a long, narrow hallway. It seemed to stretch forever before arriving at a tiny kitchen on the left side. Here were an assortment of coffees and teas, a fridge for stored lunches, all superfluous since Starbucks had a monopoly on employees' daily caffeine fixes, and all meals were carefully selected in the dining room or ordered from any one of 1,000 Midtown takeout places. But it was a nice touch, almost cute. It said, "Hey, look at us. We have Lipton tea packets and sweet and lows and even a microwave in case you want to warm up some of last night's dinner. We're just like everyone else." I finally made it to Miranda's enclave at 7:05, so tired I could barely move. But as with everything, there was yet another routine that I never thought to question or alter. So I began in earnest. I unlocked her office and turned on all the lights. It was still dark outside, and I loved the drama of standing in the dark in the powermonger's office, staring out at a flashing and restless New York City, and picturing myself in one of those movies. Take your pick. Any that have lovers embracing on the expansive terrace of his $6 million apartment with views of the river, feeling on top of the world. And then the lights would blaze forth, and my fantasy was over. The anything-is-possible feel of New York at dawn vanished, and the identical grinning faces of Caroline and Cassidy were all I could see. Next, I unlocked the closet in our outer office area, the place where I hung her coat, and mine if she wasn't wearing a fur that day. Miranda didn't like Emily's or my pedestrian wools hanging next to her minks, and where we kept a number of supplies. Cast-off coats and clothes that were worth tens of thousands of dollars, some new dry cleaning that had been delivered to the office but not yet brought up to Miranda's apartment, at least 200 of the infamous white Hermé scarves. I'd heard that Hermé had decided to discontinue her particular style last year, a simple and elegant white silk square. Someone at the company felt they owed Miranda an explanation and actually called to apologize to her. Unsurprisingly, she'd coldly told them how disappointed she was and promptly purchased their entire remaining stock. About 500 of the scarves had been delivered to the office a couple years before I'd gotten there, and we were now down to less than half. Miranda left them everywhere. Restaurants, movies, fashion shows, weekly meetings, taxis. She left them on airplanes, at her daughter's school, on the tennis court. Of course, she always had one stylishly incorporated into her outfit. I'd yet to see her outside her own home without one. But that didn't explain where they all went. Perhaps she thought they were handkerchiefs. Or maybe she liked jotting notes on silk instead of paper. Whatever it was, she seemed to truly believe they were disposable, and none of us knew how to tell her otherwise. Elias Clark had paid a couple $100 for each one, but no matter. We handed them out to her as though they were Kleenex. At the rate she was going, in under 2 years, Miranda was due to run out. I'd arranged the stiff orange boxes on the ready-to-distribute shelf of the closet, where they never remained for very long. Every third or fourth day, she'd prepare to leave for lunch and sigh, "Andrea, hand me a scarf." I comforted myself with the thought that I'd be long gone by the time she ran out of them completely. Whoever was unlucky enough to be around would have to tell her that there were no more white Hermé scarves, and that none could be made, shipped, created, formed, mailed, ordered, or mandated. The mere thought was terrifying. Just as I got the closet and office opened, Yuri called.
"Andrea, hello, hello, it is Yuri. Could you come downstairs, please? I am on 58th Street, closer to Park Avenue, right in front of the New York Sports Club. I have things for you."
This call was a good, although imperfect, way of telling me that Miranda would be arriving somewhat soon. Maybe. Most mornings she sent Yuri ahead to the office with her things, an assortment of dirty clothes that needed dry cleaning, any copy she'd taken home to read, magazines, shoes, or bags that needed to be fixed, and the book. This way she could have me meet the car and carry up all of these rather mundane things ahead of schedule and deal with them before she stepped into the office. She tended to follow her stuff by about a half hour, since Yuri would drop off her things and then go pick her up from wherever she might be hiding that morning. She herself could be anywhere, since, according to Emily, she never slept. I didn't believe it until I started getting to the office ahead of Emily and would be the first to listen to the voicemail. Every night, without exception, Miranda would leave 8 to 10 ambiguous messages for us between the hours of 1 and 6 in the morning. Things like, "Cassidy wants one of those nylon bags all the little girls are carrying. Order her one in the medium size and a color she'd like." And, "I'll be needing the address and phone number of that antique store in the 70s, the one where I saw the vintage dresser." As though we knew which nylon bags were all the rage among 10-year-olds, or at which one of 400 antique stores in the 70s, east or west, by the way, she happened to spot something she liked at some point in the past 15 years. But each morning I faithfully listened to and transcribed those messages, hitting replay over and over and over again, trying to make sense of the accent and interpret the clues in order to avoid asking Miranda directly for more information. Once, I made the mistake of suggesting that we actually ask Miranda to provide a few more details, only to be met with one of Emily's withering looks. Questioning Miranda was apparently off limits. Better to muddle through and wait to be told how off the mark our results were. To locate the vintage dresser that had caught Miranda's eye, I had spent 2.5 days in a limo cruising around Manhattan through the 70s on both sides of the park. I ruled out York Avenue, too residential, and proceeded up First, down Second, up Third, down Lex. I skipped Park, again too residential, but continued up Madison, and then repeated a similar process on the west side. Pen poised, eyes peeled, phone book open in my lap, ready to jump out at the first sight of a store that sold antiques. I graced every single antique store and not a few regular furniture stores with a personal visit. By store number 4, I had it down to an art form. "Hi, do you sell any vintage dressers?" I'd practically scream the second they buzzed me inside. By the 6th store, I wasn't even bothering to move in from the doorway. Some snotty salesperson inevitably looked me up and down. I couldn't escape it, sizing me up to decide if I was someone to be bothered with. Most would notice the waiting town car at this point and grudgingly provide me with a yes or no answer, although some wanted detailed descriptions of the dresser I was looking for. If they admitted to selling something that fit my two-word requirement, I would immediately follow up with a curt, "Has Miranda Priestley been here recently?" If they hadn't thought I was crazy at this point, they now looked ready to call security. A few had never heard her name, which was fantastic, both because it was rejuvenating to see firsthand that there were still normally functioning human beings whose lives weren't dominated by her, and also because I could promptly leave without further discussion. The pathetic majority who recognized the name became instantly curious. Some wondered which gossip column I wrote for. But regardless of whatever story I made up, no one had seen her in their shop, with the exception of 3 stores who hadn't seen Miss Priestley in months, and oh, how we miss her. Please do tell her that Frank/Charlotte/Sarabeth sends his/her love. When I hadn't located the shop by noon on the 3rd day, Emily finally gave me the green light to come to the office and ask Miranda for clarification. I started sweating when the car pulled in front of the building. I threatened to climb over the turnstile if Eduardo didn't let me pass without a performance. By the time I reached our floor, the sweat had soaked through my shirt. Hands started shaking the moment I entered the office suite, and the perfectly prepared speech, "Hello, Miranda. I'm fine. Thanks so much for asking. How are you? Listen, I just wanted to let you know that I've been trying very hard to locate the antique store you described, but I haven't had much luck. Perhaps you could tell me whether it's on the east or west side of Manhattan, or maybe you even recall the name." Simply vanished into the fickle regions of my very nervous brain. Against all protocol, I didn't post my question on the bulletin. I requested permission to approach her at her desk, and probably, because she was so shocked I'd had the nerve to speak without being spoken to, she granted it. To make a long story short, Miranda sighed and patronized and condescended and insulted in every delightful way of hers, but finally opened her black leather Hermé planner, tied shut inconveniently but chicly with a white Hermé scarf, and produced the business card for the store. "I left this information on the recording for you, Andrea. I suppose it would have been too much trouble to write it down?" And even though the yearning to make decorative paper-cut designs all over her face with the aforementioned business card filled my entire being, I simply nodded and agreed. It wasn't until I looked down at the card that I noticed the address. 244 East 68th Street. Naturally. East or West or 2nd Avenue or Amsterdam wouldn't have made a damn bit of difference, because the store I just dedicated the past 33 working hours of locating wasn't even in the 70s. I thought of this as I wrote down the last of Miranda's late-night requests before racing downstairs to meet Yuri at our designated area. Every morning he described where he parked in great detail so I could theoretically meet him at the car. But every morning, no matter how fast I made it downstairs, he'd bring everything inside himself so I wouldn't have to race up and down the street searching for him. I was delighted to see that today was no exception. He was leaning against a lobby turnstile, holding bags and clothes and books in his arms like a benevolent, generous grandfather.
"Don't you run to me, you hear?" he said in his thick Russian accent. "All day long you run, run, run. She makes you work very, very hard. This is why I bring the things to you," he said, helping me to get a grip on the overflowing bags and boxes. "You be a good girl, you hear? and have a nice day."
I shot him a grateful look, glared at Eduardo semi-jokingly, my way of saying, "I will fucking kill you if you even think of asking me to strike a pose right now," and softened a bit when he buzzed me through the turnstiles comment-free. I miraculously remembered to stop by the lobby newsstand where Ahmed piled all of Miranda's requested morning papers into my arms. Although the mailroom delivered each to Miranda's desk by 9 each day, I was still to purchase a full second set every morning to help minimize the risk that she would spend a single second in her office without her papers. Same with weekly magazines. No one seemed to mind that we charged 9 newspapers a day and 7 magazines a week for someone who read only the gossip and fashion pages. I dumped all of her stuff on the floor under my desk. It was time for the first round of ordering. I dialed the number I'd memorized long ago for Manja, a gourmet takeout place in Midtown, and, as usual, Jorge answered. "Hi, Pumpkin, it's me," I'd say, propping the phone against my shoulder so I could start logging into Hotmail. "Let's get this day started." Jorge and I were friends, talking 3, 4, 5 times a morning, had a funny way of bonding two people rather quickly.
"Hey, baby, I'll send one of the boys over right away. Is she there yet?"
he asked, understanding that she was my lunatic boss and that she worked for Runway, but not quite understanding who exactly would be consuming the breakfast I had just ordered. Jorge was one of my morning men, as I like to call them. Eduardo, Yuri, Jorge, and Ahmed gave a decent as possible start to my day. They were deliciously unaffiliated with Runway, even though their separate existences in my life were solely meant to make its editor's life more perfect. Not a single one of them truly understood Miranda's power and prestige. Breakfast number 1 would be on its way to 640 Madison in seconds, and the chances were good I'd have to throw it out. Miranda ate 4 slices of greasy fatty bacon, 2 sausage links, and a soft cheese Danish every morning, and washed it down with a tall latte from Starbucks. 2 raw sugars, remember? As far as I could tell, the office was divided on whether she was permanently on the Atkins diet or just lucky enough to have a superhuman metabolism, the result of some pretty fantastic genes. Either way, she thought nothing of devouring the fattiest, most sickeningly unhealthy foods, even though the rest of us weren't exactly afforded the same luxury. Since nothing stayed hot for more than 10 minutes after it arrived, I'd keep reordering and tossing until she showed up. I could get away with microwaving each meal 1 time, but that bought me only an extra 5 minutes, and she could usually tell.
"Andrea, this is vile. Get me a fresh breakfast at once."
I would order and reorder every 20 minutes or so until she called from her cell phone and told me to order her breakfast.
"Andrea, I'll be at the office shortly. Order my breakfast."
Of course, this was usually only a 2 or 3 minute warning, so the pre-ordering was necessary both because of the short warning and in the rather common event that she didn't bother to call at all. If I'd done my job, by the time her actual call for breakfast had come, I'd already have 2 or 3 on the way. The phone rang. It had to be her, too early to be anyone else.
"Miranda Priestley's office," I chirped, bracing myself for the iciness.
"Emily, I'll be there in 10 minutes, and I'd like my breakfast to be ready."
She had taken to calling both Emily and me Emily, suggesting, quite rightly, that we were indistinguishable from each other and completely interchangeable. Somewhere, in the back of my mind, I was offended, but I'd grown accustomed to it at this point, and besides, I was too tired to really care about something as incidental as my name.
"Yes, Miranda, right away."
But she had already hung up. The real Emily walked into the office.
"Hey, is she here?"
she whispered, looking furtively toward Miranda's office as she always did, without a hello or a good morning, just like her mentor.
"Nope, but she just called and she'll be here in 10. I'll be back."
I quickly transferred my cell phone and cigarettes to my coat pocket and ran. I had only a few minutes to get downstairs, cross Madison, and jump the line at Starbucks, and suck down my first precious cigarette of the day while in transit. Stamping out the last embers, I stumbled into the Starbucks at 57th and Lex and surveyed the line. If it was fewer than 8 or so people, I preferred to wait like a normal person. Like most days, however, the line today was 20 or more poor professional souls, wearily waiting in line for their expensive caffeine fix, and I had to jump in front of them. It was not something I relished, but Miranda didn't seem to understand that the latte I presented to her each morning could not only not be delivered, but could easily take a half hour at prime time to purchase. A couple of weeks of shrill, angry phone calls on my cell phone.
Andrea, I simply do not understand. I called you a full 25 minutes ago to tell you I'd be in, and my breakfast is not ready. This is unacceptable.
And I had spoken to the franchise manager.
Hi. Thanks for taking a minute to talk with me,
I said to the petite black woman who was in charge.
I know this sounds absolutely crazy, but I was wondering if we could work something out in terms of me having to wait in line.
I went on to explain, as best I could, that I work for a rather important, unreasonable person who doesn't like to wait for her morning coffee, and was there any way I could walk ahead of the line, subtly, of course, and have someone prepare my order immediately? By some stroke of dumb luck, Marion, the manager, was going to FIT at night for a degree in fashion merchandising.
Oh my God, are you kidding? You work for Miranda Priestley? And she drinks our lattes, at all, every morning. Unbelievable. Oh yes, yes, of course, I'll tell everyone to help you right away. Don't you worry about a thing. She is like the most powerful person in fashion,
Marion gushed, as I forced myself to nod enthusiastically. And so it came that I could, at will, bypass a long line of tired, aggressive, self-righteous New Yorkers and order before those who had been waiting for many, many minutes. It didn't make me feel good or important or even cool, and I always dreaded the days I had to do it. When the lines were hellishly long, like the one today, snaking around the entire counter and pushing its way outside, I felt even worse, and I knew I'd be walking out with a full load. My head was pounding at this point, and my eyes already felt heavy and dry. I tried to forget that this was my life, the reason I'd spent 4 long years memorizing poems and examining prose, the result of good grades and lots of kissing up. Instead, I ordered Miranda's tall latte from one of the new baristas and added a few drinks of my own. A grande amaretto cappuccino, a mocha frappuccino, and a caramel macchiato landed in my 4-cup carrier, along with a half dozen muffins and croissants. The grand total came to $28.83, and I made sure to tuck my receipt into the already bulging, specially designed receipt section of my wallet, all of which would be reimbursed by the always reliable Elias Clark. I had to hurry now, as it was already 12 minutes since Miranda had called, and I knew she'd probably be sitting there, seething, wondering exactly where I'd disappeared to every morning. The Starbucks logo on the side of the cup didn't ever clue her in. But before I could pick up all the stuff from the counter, my phone rang. And as usual, my heart lurched. I knew it was her, absolutely, positively knew it, but it scared me nonetheless. The caller ID confirmed my suspicion, and I was surprised to hear that it was Emily calling from Miranda's line.
"She's here, and she's pissed," Emily whispered. "You've got to get back here."
"I'm doing everything I can," I growled, trying to balance the carrying tray and the bag of baked goods on one arm and hold the phone with the other. And thus, the basic root of the hatred that existed between Emily and me. Since she was in the senior assistant position, I was more of Miranda's personal assistant, there to fetch those coffees and meals, help her kids with their homework, and run all over the city to retrieve the perfect dishes for her dinner parties. Emily did her expenses, made her travel arrangements, and, the biggest job of all, put through her personal clothing order every few months. So when I was out gathering the goodies each morning, Emily was left alone to handle all of the ringing phone lines and an alert early morning Miranda and all of her demands.
I hated her for being able to wear sleeveless shirts to work, where she wouldn't ever have to leave the warm office 6 times a day to race around New York, fetching, searching, hunting, gathering. She hated me for having excuses to leave the office, where she knew I always took longer than necessary to talk on my cell phone and smoke cigarettes. The walk back to the building usually took longer than the walk to Starbucks, since I had to distribute my coffees and snacks. I preferred to hand them out to the homeless, a small band of regulars who hung out on stoops and slept in doorways on 57th Street, thumbing the city's attempts to clean them up. The police always hustled them away before rush hour kicked into high gear, but they were still hanging out when I was doing the day's first coffee run. There was something so fantastic, invigorating, really, in making sure that these overpriced Elias-sponsored coffee faves made it into the hands of the city's most undesirable people. The urine-soaked man who slept outside the Chase Bank got a daily mocha frappuccino. He never actually woke up to accept it, but I left it, with a straw, of course, next to his left elbow each morning, and it was often gone, along with him, when I returned for my next coffee run a few hours later. The old lady who propped herself up on her cart and set out a cardboard sign that read, "No home, / can clean, / need food," got the caramel macchiato. I soon found her name was Teresa, and I used to buy her a tall latte like Miranda's. She always said thank you, but she never made a move to taste it while it was still hot. When I finally asked her if she wanted me to stop bringing them, she vigorously shook her head and mumbled that she hates to be picky, but she'd actually like something sweeter, that the coffee was too strong. The next day, I had her coffee flavored with vanilla and topped with whipped cream. Was this better? Oh, yes, it was much, much better. But maybe now it was a touch too sweet. One more day, and I finally got it right. It turns out Teresa liked her coffee unflavored, topped with whipped cream and some caramel syrup. She flashed a near-toothless smile and began guzzling it each and every day the moment I handed it to her. The third coffee went to Rio, the Nigerian who sold CDs off a blanket. He didn't appear to be homeless, but he walked over to me one morning when I was handing Teresa her daily fix and said, or rather sang, "Yo, yo, yo, you the Starbucks fairy or what? Where's mine?" I handed him a grande amaretto cappuccino the next day, and we've been friends ever since. I expensed $24 more every day on coffee than necessary. Miranda's single latte should have cost a mere $4. To take yet another passive-aggressive swipe at the company. My personal reprimand to them for Miranda Priestley's free reign. I handed them out to the filthy, the smelly, and the crazy, because that, and not the wasted money, was what would really piss them off. By the time I made it to the lobby, Pedro, the heavily accented Mexican delivery boy from Manja, was chatting in Spanish with Eduardo near the elevator bank.
"Hey, here's our girlie," said Pedro, as a few clackers peered over at us. "I got the usual, bacon, sausage, and one nasty-looking cheese thing. You ordered only one today. I don't know how you eat this shit and stay so thin, girl."
He grinned. I suppressed the urge to tell him he didn't have a clue what thin looked like. Pedro knew full well that I was not the one eating his breakfasts, but like every one of the dozen or so people I spoke to before 8 a.m. each day, he didn't really know the details. I handed him a 10, as usual, for the $3.99 breakfast and headed upstairs. She was on the phone when I entered the office, her snakeskin Gucci trench draped across the top of my desk. My blood pressure increased tenfold. Would it kill her to take the extra 2 steps over to the closet, open it, and hang up her own coat? Why did she have to take it off and fling it over my desk? I put down the latte, looked over at Emily, who was too busy answering 3 phone lines to notice me, and hung up the snakeskin. I shook off my own coat and bent down to toss it underneath my desk, since mine might infect hers if they mingled in the closet. I grabbed 2 raw sugars, a stirrer, and a napkin from a stock I kept in my desk drawer, and wrapped them all together.
I briefly considered spitting in the drink, but I was able to restrain myself. Next, I pulled a small china plate from the overhead bin and dumped out the greasy meat and the oozing Danish, wiping my hands on her dirty dry cleaning, which was hidden beneath my desk so she couldn't see it hadn't been picked up yet. I was theoretically supposed to clean her plate each day in the sink in our mock-up kitchen, but I just couldn't bring myself to bother. The humiliation of doing her dishes in front of everyone prompted me to wipe it down with tissues after each meal and scrape off any leftover cheese with my fingernails. If it was really dirty or had been sitting for a long time, I'd open a bottle of the Pellegrino we kept by the case and dump a little bit on. I figured she should be thankful I wasn't using a spritz or two of desk cleaner. I was reasonably sure that I had reached a new moral low. What was worrisome was that I'd sunk to it so naturally. "Remember, I want my girl smiling," she was saying into the phone. I could tell from her tone she was talking to Lucia, the fashion director who'd be in charge of the upcoming Brazil shoot, about how the model should appear. "Happy, lots of teeth, clean, healthy girls, no brooding, no anger, no frowning, no dark makeup. I want them shining. I mean it, Lucia. I will accept nothing less." I set the plate on the edge of her desk and placed the latte and the napkin with all necessary accessories next to it. She didn't look at me. I paused for a moment to see if she'd hand me a pile of papers off her desk, things to fax or find or file, but she ignored me, and I walked out. 8:30 a.m. I'd been awake now for 3 full hours, felt like I'd already worked for 12, and could finally sit down for the very first time all morning. Just as I was logging onto Hotmail, anticipating some fun emails from people on the outside, she walked out. The belted jacket cinched her already tiny waist and complemented the perfectly fitted pencil skirt she wore beneath it. She looked dynamite.
"Andrea, the latte is ice cold. I don't understand why. You were certainly gone long enough. Bring me another."
I inhaled deeply and concentrated on keeping the look of hatred off my face. Miranda set the offending latte on my desk and flipped through the new issue of Vanity Fair that a staffer had set on the table for her. I could feel Emily watching me and knew her look would be one of sympathy and anger. She felt bad that I had to repeat the hellish ordeal all over again, but she hated me for daring to be upset about it. After all, wouldn't a million girls die for my job? And so, with an audible sigh, something I'd perfected lately, so it was just enough Miranda could hear but not nearly enough she could ever call me on it, I once again put on my coat and willed my legs to move toward the elevators. It was going to be another long, long day. The second coffee run in 20 minutes went much more smoothly. The lines at Starbucks had thinned a little, and Marion had come on duty. She herself got to work on a tall latte as soon as I walked in the door. I didn't bother overspending on a larger order this time because I was too desperate to just get back and sit down, but I did add 20 cappuccinos for both Emily and me. Just as I was paying for the coffee, my phone rang. God damn it to hell, this woman was impossible. Insatiable, impatient, impossible. I hadn't been gone for more than 4 minutes. She couldn't possibly be freaking out yet. Again, I balanced my tray in one hand and pulled my phone from my coat pocket. I'd already decided that such behavior on her part warranted my having another cigarette, if just to hold up her coffee a few minutes longer. When I saw that it was Lily calling from her home phone. "Hey, bad time?" she asked, sounding excited. I looked at my watch and saw that she should have been in class.
Sort of. I'm on my second coffee run, which is really great. I'm really, really enjoying myself, just in case you're wondering. What's up? Don't you have class now? Yeah, but I went out with Pink Shirt Boy again last night and we each drank a few too many margaritas. Like, 8 too many. He's still passed out here, so I can't just leave him. But that's not why I'm calling.
Yeah? I was barely listening since one of the cappuccinos was starting to leak, and I had the phone wedged in between my neck and my shoulder as I used my one free hand to pluck a cigarette from the box and light it.
My landlord had the nerve to knock on my door at 8 o'clock this morning and tell me that I'm being evicted,
she said, with not a little bit of glee in her voice.
Evicted? Lil, why? What are you going to do?
It seems they finally caught on that I'm not Sandra Gers and that she hasn't lived here for 6 months. Since she's technically not family, she wasn't allowed to pass down the rent control department to me. I knew that, of course, so I've just been saying I'm her. I don't really know how they found out, but whatever, it doesn't really matter because now you and I can live together. Your lease with Shanti and Kendra is just month to month, right? You subletted because you had no place to live, right?
Right.
Well, now you do. We can get a place together anywhere we like.
That's great.
It sounded hollow to my ears, even though I was genuinely excited.
So, you're up for it? She asked, her enthusiasm sounding a bit dampened. Lil, definitely. Honestly, it's an awesome idea. I don't mean to sound negative. It's just that it's sleeting and I'm standing outside and I have burning hot coffee running down my left arm.
Beep, beep.
The other line rang. And even though I almost burned my neck with the lit end of the cigarette while trying to pull my phone away from my ear, I was able to see that it was Emily calling.
Shit, Lil, it's Miranda calling. I've got to run, but congrats on getting evicted. I'm so excited for us. I'll call you later, okay?
Okay, I'll talk to... I'd already clicked over and mentally prepared myself for the barrage.
Me again, Emily said tightly. What the hell is going on? It's a fucking coffee, for Christ's sake. You forget that I used to do your job, and I know it doesn't take that long to...
What? I said loudly, holding a few fingers over the microphone on the receiver.
What did you say? I can't hear you. Well, if you can hear me, I'll be back in just a minute.
And I clicked my phone shut and buried it deep in my pocket. And even though I had at least half a Marlboro left, I dropped it on the sidewalk and ran back to work. Miranda deigned to accept this slightly warmer latte, and even gave us a few moments of peace between 10 and 11, when she sat in her office with the door closed, cooing to B-Dad. I'd officially met him for the first time the week before, when I dropped the book off that Wednesday night around 9. He had been removing his coat from the closet in the foyer, and spent the next 10 minutes referring to himself in the third person. Since that meeting, he had paid me extra special attention when I let myself in each night, always taking a few minutes to ask about my day or compliment me on a job well done. Naturally, none of these niceties seemed to rub off on his wife, but at least he was pleasant to be around. I was just about to begin calling some of the PR people to see about getting a few more decent clothes to wear to work when Miranda's voice shook me from my thoughts.
Emily, I'd like my lunch,
she had called from her office to no one in particular, since Emily could mean either of us. The real Emily looked at me and nodded, and I knew it was okay to move. The number for Smith and Walensky was programmed into my desk phone, and I recognized the voice at the other end as the new girl.
Hey, Kim, it's Andrea from Miranda Priestley's office. Is Sebastian there?
Oh, hi. What did you say your name was again?
No matter that I called at the exact same time, twice a week, and had already identified myself, she always acted as though we'd never spoken.
From Miranda Priestley's office at Runway. Listen, I don't mean to be rude.
Yes, actually, I do.
But I'm kind of in a hurry. Could you just put Sebastian on?
If anyone else had answered, I would have been able to just tell that person to put in an order for Miranda's usual. But since this one was too dumb to be trusted, I had learned to ask for the manager himself.
Okay. Let me check and see if he's available.
Trust me, Kim, he's available. Miranda Priestley is his life.
Andy, dear, how are you? Sebastian breathed into the phone. I hope you're calling because our favorite fashion editor would like some lunch today, yes?
I wondered what he'd say if I told him just once that it wasn't Miranda who was looking for lunch, but me. After all, this wasn't exactly a takeout joint, but they made a special exception for the queen herself.
Oh, yes, indeed. She was just saying how much she was in the mood for something delicious from your restaurant, and she also said to send her love.
If under threat of death or dismemberment, Miranda wouldn't have been able to identify the name of the place that made her lunch each day, never even mind the name of its daytime manager, but he always seemed so happy when I said something like this. Today, he was so excited, he giggled.
Fab! That's just fabulous! We'll have it ready for you as soon as you get here,
he called with fresh excitement in his voice.
Can't wait! And give her my love, too, of course.
Of course I will. See you soon. It was exhausting to stroke his ego so enthusiastically, but he made my job so much easier, it was well worth it. Every day that Miranda didn't have lunch out, I served her the same meal at her desk, and she leisurely ate it behind closed doors. I kept a supply of china plates in the bins above my desk for this purpose. Most were samples sent by designers whose new home lines had just come out, although some I just took directly from the dining room. It would have been too annoying to have to keep stock of things like gravy trays and steak knives and linen napkins, though, so Sebastian was always sure to provide those with the meal. And once again, I shrugged on my black wool coat and jammed my cigarettes and phone in the pocket and headed outside, into a late February day that seemed to get only grayer as it progressed. Although it was just a 15-minute walk to the restaurant on 49th and 3rd, I considered calling for a car, but thought better of it when I felt the clean air in my lungs. When I exhaled, I wasn't sure if it was smoke or cold air or irritation, but it felt damn good. Dodging the aimlessly meandering tourists had become easier. I used to stare in disgust at pedestrians on cell phones, but given my hectic days, I'd become a walking talker. I pulled my cell out and called Alex's school where, according to my fuzzy recollection, he could possibly be eating his lunch in the faculty lounge at that moment. It rang twice before I heard a high-pitched, pinched woman's voice answer.
Hello, you've reached PS 277 and this is Mrs. Whitmore speaking. How may I help you?
Is Alex Feynman there?
And who may I ask is calling?
This is Andrea Sachs, Alex's girlfriend.
Ah, yes, Andrea, we've all heard so much about you.
Her words were so clipped she sounded as though she might choke any moment.
Oh, really? That's good. I've heard a lot about you, too, of course. Alex says wonderful things about everyone at school. Well, isn't that nice? But seriously, Andrea, it sounds like you have quite some job there. How interesting it must be, working for such a talented woman. You're a lucky girl indeed.
Ah, yes, Mrs. Whitmore, I am a lucky girl, indeed. I'm so lucky. You have no idea. I can't tell you how lucky I felt when I was sent out just yesterday afternoon to purchase tampons for my boss, only to be told that I'd bought the wrong ones and asked why I do nothing right. And luck is probably the only way to explain why I get to sort another person's sweat and food-stained clothing each morning before 8 and arrange to have it cleaned. Oh, wait. I think what actually makes me luckiest of all is getting to talk to breeders all over the tri-state area for 3 straight weeks in search of the perfect French bulldog puppy so 2 incredibly spoiled and unfriendly little girls can each have their own pet. Yes, that's it. Oh, yes, well, it's a fantastic opportunity, I said by rote. A job a million girls would die for.
Well, you can say that again, dear. And guess what? Alex just walked in. I'll put him on.
Hey, Andy, what's going on? How's your day going?
Don't ask. I'm on my way to pick up her lunch right now. How's your day?
Good so far. My class has music today right after lunch, so I actually have an hour and a half free, which is nice. And then we get to cover more phonics exercises, he said, sounding just a little defeated. Even though it seems like they're never going to learn how to actually read something.
Well, have there been any slashings today?
No.
So how much can you ask for? You've had a relatively pain-free, bloodless day. Enjoy it. Save the whole reading concept for tomorrow. So guess what? Lily called this morning. She finally got evicted from her place in Harlem, so we're going to move in together. Fun, right?
Hey, congratulations. Couldn't have been better timing for you. You guys will have a great time together. Come to think of it, it's a little scary. Dealing with Lily full-time and Lily's guys? Promise we can stay at my place a lot?
Of course, but you'll feel right at home.
It'll be just like senior year all over again.
Too bad she's losing that cheap apartment. Other than that, it's great news.
Yeah, I'm psyched. Shanti and Kendra are fine, but I'm kind of done with the whole living with strangers thing. I loved Indian food, but I did not love how the curry smell had seeped into everything I owned. I'm going to see if Lil wants to meet for a drink tonight to celebrate. You up for it? We'll meet somewhere in the East Village so it's not too far for you.
Yeah, sure, sounds great. I'm running to Largemont to watch Joey tonight, but I'll be back in the city by 8. You won't even be out of work by then, so I'll meet Max and we can all meet up afterward. Hey, is Lily seeing anyone? Max could use a... well...
A what? I laughed. Go on, say it. Do you think my friend is a whore? She's just free-spirited is all. And is she seeing someone? What kind of a question is that? Someone named Pink Shirt Boy stayed over there last night. I don't think I know his real name.
Whatever. Anyway, the bell just rang. Call me when you're done dropping off the book.
Will do. Bye. I was about to stash the phone when it rang again. The number wasn't familiar, though, and I answered it out of sheer relief that it wasn't Miranda or Emily. Hello? I'd taken to automatically answering my cell and home phone, Miranda Priestley's office, which was supremely embarrassing when it was anyone except my parents or Lily. Had to work on that.
Is this the lovely Andrea Sachs whom I inadvertently terrified at Marshall's party?
Asked a somewhat hoarse and very sexy voice on the other end. Christian. I'd been almost relieved when he hadn't resurfaced anywhere after massaging my hand with his lips. But all the feelings of wanting to impress him with my wit and charm that first night came rushing back, and I quickly vowed to play it cool.
It is, and whom I ask is this? There were a number of men who terrified me that night for dozens of different and varied reasons.
Okay, so far so good. Deep breath. Be cool.
I didn't realize I had so much competition, he said smoothly. But I suppose I shouldn't be surprised. Have you been, Andrea?
Fine. Great, actually. I lied quickly, remembering a Cosmo article I'd read that had exhorted me to keep it light and airy and happy when talking to a new guy because most normal guys didn't respond so well to hard-bitten cynicism. Work is going really well. I'm loving my job, actually. It's been really interesting lately. A lot to learn. Tons of stuff going on. Yeah, it's great. What about you?
Don't talk about yourself too much. Don't dominate the conversation. Get him comfortable enough to chat about his favorite and most familiar topic, him.
You're a rather deft liar, Andrea. To an untrained ear, that almost sounded believable. But you know what they say, don't you? You can't bullshit a bullshitter. Don't worry, though. I'll let you get away with it this time.
I opened my mouth to deny the accusation, but instead, I just laughed. A perceptive one indeed.
Let me get right to the point here because I'm about to get on a plane for D.C. and security doesn't look all too happy that I'm walking through a metal detector while talking on the phone. Do you have plans for Saturday night?
I hated when people phrased their questions that way. Asked if you had plans before they told you what they had in mind. Did his girlfriend need someone to run errands for her, and he thought I fit the bill? Or maybe he needed someone to walk his dog while he gave yet another 8-hour-long interview to the New York Times. I was considering what non-committal way I could answer that question when he said,
So, I had a reservation at Babbo this Saturday, 9 o'clock. A bunch of friends will be there, too, mostly magazine editors and pretty interesting people. An editor from The Buzz and a couple of writers from The New Yorker. Good crowd. You up for it?
At that exact moment, an ambulance roared past me with its siren wailing, lights flashing in a fruitless attempt to speed through the hopelessly gridlocked traffic. As usual, the drivers ignored the ambulance and it sat at the red light like all the other vehicles.
Had he just asked me out? Yes, I thought. That's exactly what had just happened. He was asking me out.
He was asking me out. Christian Collinsworth was asking me on a date. A Saturday night date, to be specific. And to Babbo, where he just so happened to have a prime-time reservation with a group of smart, interesting people, people just like him. Never even mind the New Yorker writers. I racked my brain, trying to remember if I'd mentioned to him at the party that Babbo was the one restaurant I most wanted to try in New York,
that I loved Italian and knew how much Miranda loved it, and I was dying to go. I'd even thought about blowing a week's pay on a meal, and I'd called to make a reservation for Alex and me, but they'd been booked solid for the next 5 months. I hadn't been asked on a date by anyone other than Alex in 3 years.
Christian, golly, I'd love to, I started, trying to forget immediately that I just said golly.
Golly? Who said that?
The scene where Baby proudly announces to Johnny that she'd carried a watermelon flashed to mind, but I pushed it back and willed myself to forge forward despite the humiliation.
I'd really love to.
Yes, you idiot, you just said that. Try to make some progress here.
But I just can't do it. I already have plans for Saturday.
A good response overall, I thought. I was shouting over the noise of the siren, but I thought I still sounded somewhat dignified. No need to be available for a date that was only 2 days away, and no real need to reveal existence of boyfriend. After all, it wasn't really any of his business, right?
Do you really have plans, Andrea, or do you think your boyfriend would disapprove of you going out with another man?
He was fishing, I could tell.
Either way, it has nothing to do with you, I said prissily, and I actually rolled my eyes at myself.
I crossed Third Avenue without noticing that the light was against me and almost got mowed down by a minivan.
Okay, well, I'll let you off this time, but I'll be asking again, and I think next time you'll say yes.
Oh, really? What gives you that impression?
The confidence that had seemed so sexy before was now starting to sound a whole lot like arrogance. The only problem was that it made him sound even sexier.
Just a hunch, Andrea. Just a hunch. And no need to worry that pretty little head of yours or your boyfriend's. I was just extending a friendly invitation for a good meal and good company. Maybe he'd like to join us, Andrea, your boyfriend. He must be a great guy. I'd really like to meet him.
No,
I almost shouted, horrified at the thought of the two of them sitting across a table from each other, each so amazing in such radically different ways. I'd be ashamed for Christian to see Alex's wholesomeness, his do-gooder ways. To Christian, Alex would seem like a naive hick, and I'd be even more ashamed for Alex to see with his own eyes all the ugly things I found so incredibly attractive about Christian. The style, the cockiness, a self-assuredness so rock-solid it seemed impossible to insult him.
No,
I laughed, or rather forced a laugh, as I tried to make it sound casual.
I'm not so sure that that's a good idea, although I'm sure he'd just love to meet you, too.
He laughed with me, but it had turned mocking, patronizing.
I was just kidding, Andrea. I'm sure your boyfriend's a really great guy, but I'm not particularly interested in meeting him.
Well, of course. Sure. I mean, I knew what you...
Listen, I gotta run. Why don't you give me a call if you change your mind? Or your plans, okay? Offer's still open. Oh, and have a great day.
And before I could say another word, he'd hung up.
What the hell had just happened?
I ran through it again. Hot, smart writer had somehow found my cell number, called it, and fully asked me on a date for Saturday night to hot, trendy restaurant. I wasn't clear whether he knew ahead of time if I had a boyfriend or not, but he didn't appear particularly daunted by the information. The only thing I knew for sure was that I'd spent way too long chatting on the phone, a fact confirmed by a quick glance at my watch. It had been 32 minutes since I'd left the office, longer than the time it usually took me to get lunch and come back. I stashed the phone and realized I'd already made it to the restaurant. I pulled open the lumbering wooden door and stepped into the hushed, darkened dining room. Even though every table was filled with Midtown bankers and lawyers gnawing on their favorite steaks, there was barely any noise at all, as if the plush carpeting and manly color scheme just absorbed all the sound.
Andrea!
I heard Sebastian cry from the hostess stand. He beelined toward me as though I might be holding the last of a life-saving medication.
We're just all so glad you're here.
Two young girls in crisp gray skirt suits nodded seriously behind him.
Oh, really? Why is that?
I could never help myself toying with Sebastian just a little. He was such an unbelievable kiss-ass. He leaned over conspiratorially, his excitement palpable.
Well, you know how the entire staff here at Smith & Walensky feels about Miss Priestley, don't you? Runway is such a gorgeous magazine. What with all the beautiful shoots and stunning style and, of course, fascinating, literate articles. We all just adore it.
Literate articles, huh? I asked, suppressing the huge smile that was threatening to emerge. He nodded proudly and turned as one of the suited helpers tapped him on the shoulder to hand him a tote bag. He literally cried out in joy.
Aha! Here we have it, one perfectly prepared lunch for one perfect editor and one perfect assistant, he added while winking at me.
Thank you, Sebastian. We both appreciate it. I opened the natural cotton tote, a bag that looked just like those uber-cool ones from the Strand that all the NYU students slung over their shoulder, but without the logo, and made sure everything was right. 1 1/4-pound ribeye, bleeding all over the container, so raw it just might not have been cooked at all. Check. 2 baked potatoes the size of small kittens, each steaming hot. Check. 1 small side container of smashed potatoes, made soft with lots of heavy cream and extra butter. Check. Precisely 8 perfect stalks of asparagus, with the tips looking plump and juicy, and the ends shaved to a clean white finish. Check. There was also a metal gravy boat full of softened butter, a pinch box overflowing with grainy kosher salt, a wooden-handled steak knife, and a crisp white linen napkin, which today was folded into the shape of a pleated skirt. How adorable. Sebastian waited to see if I liked it.
Very nice, Sebastian, I said as though I were praising a puppy for going number 2 outside. You really outdid yourself today.
He beamed and then looked at the ground in practiced humility.
Well, thank you. You know how I feel about Miss Priestley, and well, it's really an honor to, well, you know.
Prepare her lunch, I supplied helpfully.
Well, yes, exactly. You know what I mean.
Yes, of course I do, Sebastian. She'll love it, I'm sure. I didn't have the heart to tell him that I immediately unfolded all of his creations, because the Ms. Priestley he so adored would throw a hissy fit if faced with a napkin in the shape of anything other than a napkin, never mind a bowling bag or a high-heeled shoe. I tucked the bag under my arm and turned to leave, but just then my phone rang. Sebastian looked at me expectantly, fervently hoping that the voice on the other line of my cell phone would be his love, his reason for living. He wasn't let down.
Is this Emily? Emily, is that you? I can barely hear you.
Miranda's voice came over the line in a shrill, angry staccato.
Hello, Miranda. Yes, this is Andrea, I stated calmly, while Sebastian visibly swooned at the sound of her name. Are you preparing my lunch yourself, Andrea? Because according to my clock, I asked for it 35 minutes ago. I cannot think of a single reason why, if you were doing your job properly, my lunch would not be at my desk yet. Can you?
She got my name right. A small success, but no time to celebrate.
Well, I'm very sorry it's taken so long, but there was a little mix-up with...
You do know just how uninterested I am in such details, do you not?
Yes, of course, I understand, and it won't be long before...
I am calling to tell you that I want my lunch, and I want it now. There's really not much room for nuance, Emily. I want my lunch now.
With that, she hung up the phone, and my hands were shaking so badly I dropped my cell on the floor. It might as well have been covered in burning arsenic. Sebastian, who looked ready to pass out from the action, swooped down to retrieve the phone and hand it back to me.
Is she upset with us, Andrea? I hope she doesn't think we let her down, does she? Does she think that?
His mouth pursed into a tight oval, and the already prominent veins in his forehead pulsed. And I wanted to hate him as much as I hated her, but I just felt sorry for him. Why did this man who seemed remarkable only to the extent that he was so unremarkable, Why did he care so much about Miranda Priestly? Why was he so invested in pleasing her, impressing her, providing for her? Perhaps he should take over my job, I thought, because I was going to quit.